Hello and welcome to Adler University on Social Health and Change podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and today we're talking sex. In our first segment, we're going to address what good sex education looks like and really why it's so important. And then later on, we'll discuss non-monogamous relationships and what to do if your child comes out as gay. With us currently is Kalki Nakai, a doctoral candidate in Adler's Doctor of Psychology and Clinical Psychology program. Kalki has certification in sex education for young adults, and she wrote her dissertation on porn literacy. Kalki, thank you so much for your time and being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It is fascinating not only when I read the bio just now, but when I read your bio initially, I was really, really intrigued by what you were going to bring to the listeners. And also, since I brought the listeners up, I want to remind them to make sure to subscribe to our podcast so that these will auto-populate in your devices. And you can do that via, of course, iTunes, wherever you download your Android podcasts, or right there via the WGNplus.com page. So, Kalki, again, thank you for being here. To jump right into this, I know so many people, especially parents, teachers, etc., really mainly parents, sex ed is an uncomfortable topic. If you can explain to us, kind of broad stroke, why is it so important?
That's a great question, Hannah. And I think it's easy to say that without comprehensive sex education, we're facing substantial public health and financial issues. So it's without being said that sex is sort of really interesting for youth. They may end up having sex around the age of 17. There are some theories that explain why youth are engaging in earlier sex. Could be from peer pressure to lack of structural activities or adult supervision, or maybe some other structural factors like economic inequality or social marginalization or even media influences. But the statistics are out there that show that youth from 15 to 24 actually have the highest STI rates and unintended pregnancies. So we're looking at without education or access to condoms or contraception, youth are just more likely to become early parents. And there's a figure out there that shows about 60% of teen moms don't graduate from high school. They're more likely than their peers to live in poverty, to depend on public assistance, and be in poor health. But their children also suffer. They have maybe more health and cognitive disadvantage. They're on child welfare or involved with the correctional system. They themselves end up living in poverty, will drop out of high school, and become teen parents themselves. So alarmingly, every year, the United States spends about $9 billion on child-rearing costs. This doesn't include the cost of treating STIs, which is about $6 billion, and that doesn't account for spending on HIV and AIDS treatment. So really, sexual risk-taking is the pertinent concern in the context of sexual and reproductive health, social justice, and overall well-being among youth. So while there has been evidence that teen pregnancies and STI rates have gone down in the last 25 years because of comprehensive sex education, we're still the only industrialized nation to have the highest rates of teen pregnancies and STIs. So really, comprehensive sex ed is important because it's designed to improve public health access and information, but it's there to help youth make safe, consensual, and informed decisions about their own bodies, about sexuality, and relationships.
All right. One, I want to clarify two things. STIs are sexually transmitted infections.
That's correct.
Okay, excellent. As I upspeak on that, so I apologize to everyone listening that I went a bit Kardashian on you. And then you said that those rates, while they have dropped, are still very high. Is this because kids are still having sex, even though they're not knowing anything about how to make those decisions necessarily properly? They don't have all the facts in front of them to prevent and protect themselves.
Yeah, they don't have all the facts, but they also don't have access to contraception or contraceptives. They don't know where to go to get this information, but to get the services that could be STI testing, HIV testing, where to go get pap smears, or, you know, just taking care of their health in general. So it's useful to teach education and also the skills that helps to delay sexual initiation, but it's to prepare them with this information and the skills so that they can protect themselves and their partners when they do become sexually active.
Okay, so ignoring it is not making it go away. They're still going to do this. They're just not informed. And to cut right to the crux of this, having that ignorance out there is costing us a lot of money. So when we talk about comprehensive sex education, how are abstinent-only programs fitting in here?
Well, simply put, Hannah, you know, youth are thirsty for sex ed. I mean, abstinent-only programs, they just don't provide or include information about contraception or disease prevention methods. So even though the government had funding had spent, I think, over $1.5 million for abstinent-only programs under the Bush administration, there is substantial evidence that demonstrates that the states that only rely on abstinent-only programs are seeing higher rates of teen pregnancies and STIs. So this isn't really coincidental, like we were talking about. When you're removing education and access to services, youth are still engaging in sex because this is a normative developmental process. But now they don't have access to the right information or to the services to help them engage in safe, consensual, and protected sex. But what's interesting is that abstinent-only programs were actually found more practical for younger age youth. So if professionals are teaching sex ed and abstinence at an earlier age, youth could actually benefit from developing healthier sexual attitudes and having a more secure identity against sexual pressure. So right now, I think about 19 states require that sex ed only include what's called abstinence only until marriage education. And these programs only emphasize abstinence from all sexual behaviors outside of marriage. So they typically emphasize failure rates of contraception and disease prevention methods, and they only present marriage as the option for morally correct sex, basically. But in President Obama's budget for fiscal year 2017, he's eradicating abstinence only until marriage funding. But there are still resources available for communities of faith to teach sexuality and healthy relationships all throughout the lifespan, from pre-kindergarten to older adults.
Okay, so I think it's been pretty clear that your opinion is that that is not a really good plan. Abstinence only doesn't necessarily work. While it could be still very accepted in many, many communities, it based on your research and the stats behind it, it's not the way to go. So tell me what a good sex ed program looks like.
This is a really good question. Good sex education looks like medically accurate, age-appropriate, and evidence-based information. In 2014, President Obama provided $185 million to fund comprehensive sex education. So as of January 2015, 22 states, including the District of Columbia, are requiring public schools to teach sex ed, and 20 of those states mandate the requirement, where 19 are asking that the information is medically accurate. So there's six different domains that really highlight what good sex education looks like, and that includes human development, which is looking at reproduction and sexual anatomy, puberty, body image, sexual orientation, gender identity. It's also looking at relationships between family, friends, but also the nuances of love, of dating, what marriage looks like, what raising children looks like. Also looking at personal skills like values and decision making. So looking at risk versus responsibility, communication skills with regard to negotiation, boundary setting, refusal skills, how to seek out help and use resources. Also looking at sexual behavior, so not just abstinence, but also masturbation, fantasy, and dysfunction. And then, of course, sexual health, looking at reproductive health, contraception, STI, HIV, AIDS, pregnancy, abortion, but also what consent looks like as far as you know, what is happening in the relationship considered sexual abuse, assault, or violence? And then finally, kind of looking at society and culture. So discussing power and privilege and gender roles, looking at law, religion, diversity, the arts, and the media, particularly with internet pornography. So the goal of good sex education, aside from learning accurate information, is giving youth the opportunity to question, to explore, to assess their attitudes and values in contrast to what they've learned from their family, from culture, from society. It's asking children or youth to improve their critical thinking skills. It'll help them increase their self-esteem, their self-efficacy, to develop interpersonal skills where they can have respectful, supportive, and pleasurable relationships. But all in all, the major goal is really to promote personal and social responsibility.
But the question for many, many parents, and I'm one of them, is when should we teach this? And when, as parents, should we start talking about this?
This is, I think, the golden question. And this can often become really controversial, depending on your values and what you feel is appropriate, but also what your comfort level is in discussing sex with your spouse or with your friends. So there's a lot of different factors involved in the sources and timing of sex education. But the research really shows that the healthy sexual development of children really comes from the home. So if there's a collaboration between home and school education, this is where we can start to address the risk-taking, but also promote responsibility. We want to prepare them throughout their lifespan on how to navigate a sexualized world or their sexual relationships. So, you know, there's age-appropriate education, for instance, during, you know, kindergarten through third grade. You know, perhaps parents can have a dialogue about giving information on understanding body parts with proper anatomical names, as well as understanding appropriate and inappropriate touch, like you're looking at boundaries and you're trying to help the child not put shame around the body part or around the topic. You're normalizing this conversation and you're inviting them to have more conversations with you as a safe agent throughout their lives. Then as they grow, maybe into fourth and fifth grade, they can actually discuss the changes that occur during puberty, maybe learning respect for diverse family structures and gender expression. As they venture into middle school, then they can learn about healthy body image, analyzing media influences, dealing with peer pressure, and emphasizing the choice of abstinence with the education on contraceptives. And then finally, in high school, this is where youth can actually learn how to access accurate information, where to go to receive services in the community for contraception or STI HIV testing, talking about healthy relationships and boundary setting, and also what the effects of alcohol and other drugs are on decision making, and even information on the financial responsibility it takes for raising their own children. So that's sort of like a small example of what age-appropriate education can look like throughout development.
So I like that you address the fact that obviously people have to address their own comfort level, because that's going to be some people just don't, they're not comfortable talking about it themselves, let alone addressing it with their children. So really good information on looking online and finding resources that are already available. And I have to jump in. I love the video with the tea, how it explains consent. I'm guessing you've seen that. I just think that's genius. this. So if anybody needs to understand what consent is, look for, just Google T and consent, and it explains everything. Kalki, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate you being here. And when we come back, we're going to talk with a psychologist about how to best support your child when he or she comes out as gay. Again, this is Hannah Stanley, your host for On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And don't forget to hit subscribe. We'll be right back.